Hi, and welcome to the first audio excerpt from my book, Rise and Shine. So you know how books often have a saying at the beginning? Well, this is the one that I chose for this book, and it's by a woman named Emily Maughan, who says, "My ambition in life is to someday be the person my dog thinks I am." Now, I have no idea how to edit or correct anything while I'm doing this reading, so I am going to make mistakes. So I just ask your patience. I'll just kind of laugh about it and correct it and carry on. So I'm going to begin with the foreword. So Rise and Shine is a spiritual, mental, and physical survival kit presented by an unlikely team of experts. But they know what they're talking about. You'll meet them soon. And you'll meet Truman and come to understand what real change looks like, and redemption. Better still, you'll be given all the information that he received, information that will assist you to navigate the minefield of our ever more complicated world, with some ease, perhaps even with grace. You don't need to believe in any particular god or religion to transform your life with this information. In fact, you can be an atheist and still benefit from using this survival kit, or more accurately, kits. You have the right to be skeptical. You want to know how. Consider the response given a tourist by Lily Tomlin's bag lady Trudy. When asked how to get to Carnegie Hall, she shouts, "Practice." That's the answer to your question. You'll be learning a practice that will help you rise and then shine. The story begins. Dr. Truman Grable is about to die. He doesn't know this. Some deaths come without warning. His will be one of those. At the moment he sits in his office listening to a patient, because that's what he's paid to do, death is the farthest thing from his mind. He's irritated because he's been listening to this woman's battle with depression for over a year, and her progress has been painfully slow. His mind drifts, he catches the end of a sentence, but he has no idea how it began. He feels a sense of unease as she turns to look at him, waiting for, he's not sure what, a reaction, a response. What is she waiting for? What does she need? Truman prides himself on his ability to say the right thing at the right time, but he's confused. His tie feels uncomfortably tight, he's having difficulty breathing, his heart is racing, he feels hot, sweat breaks out on his forehead. "Dr. Grable, are you all right?" are the last words he hears. The pain is swift and hard. His hands fly to his chest. Within seconds, it's all over. Well, not quite. It only seems on the outside that Truman has died. Inside, in what appears to be a movie, he sees a lifetime that's barely recognizable, squeezed into a momentary flash, a story presented in a language he neither speaks nor comprehends. This is not the life he remembers, not the autobiography he would have written. It's a parallel story that makes no mention of the large donations he made over the years to numerous worthy causes. He has the receipts to prove it. There's nothing about how well he took care of his wife and children, two of them, adults now, living their own lives, a disappointment, both of them. His daughter Terry had a passion for plants and flowers and trees. He thought it was a passing fancy, but she decided to become a landscape artist, terminology he refused to use, calling it yard labor or gardening, much to her annoyance. He never understood why a girl with such promise would choose to spend her time covered in mud. His son's choices were even worse. There was no blinding white light, no tunnel, no winged messenger to guide him to who knows where, just darkness and what seemed like an interminable amount of time to ponder his life as it has been presented to him. He saw a small man, not in stature, but in his relationship with the world. He saw a brittle, critical man adrift in pettiness, constantly looking for flaws and weaknesses in everyone he met. He tenaciously held to his own narrow version of the truth. He was bad-tempered, judgmental, and driven. As he tried to adjust to this less than flattering picture, he found himself hovering over what appeared to be his own funeral. His wife, inappropriately, according to him, dressed in a soft gray, not black, cashmere coat, stood dry-eyed beside the hole into which was being lowered an unexceptional coffin. Beside her, his arm around her shoulder, was a man Truman had never seen before. His daughter, the gardener, was fussing with a floral arrangement. His son was fiddling with his iPhone, no doubt texting. There was no one else. Well, of course, there was a priest or something of that sort, reading from a scrap of paper the usual cliches, clearly uncomfortable with the lack of information about whom he called the dearly departed. And the children had brought their dogs. They were well aware of Truman's dislike of animals in general and dogs in particular, which was why they said they didn't like to visit him. Now that he was gone, they appeared to feel they could do as they pleased. Not one of his colleagues was present. He barely had time to get over his disappointment before he was sucked into a vortex and brought down to earth, very close to earth, in fact, and his sense of smell was beyond anything he could remember. Hundreds of new odors bombarded him from all directions. It was intoxicating and confusing. Truman could not make any sense of what was happening to him. It was about then that denial set in. He knew about denial. He'd written a well-received book on the subject and was considered an expert on all things related. Quite simply, denial was being handed a mountain of evidence, usually negative in nature, and then searching through it in the hope of turning up a good excuse or a justification, or if all else failed, a suitable lie. The evidence being presented to him went as follows. He was close to the ground, which was odd because he was not a short man. His sense of smell had dramatically improved. His body was covered with hair, and although he was not hairless in what he thought of as his real life, he certainly wasn't completely covered with it. In his real life, he had an excellent vocabulary, much better than the norm, which nowadays he considered to be increasingly diminished by the use of cell phones, texting, tweeting, and so on, which brought to mind the endless battles with his son, who couldn't converse more than 30 seconds without glancing at his iPhone. Attention span of a gnat was how Truman described the new generation. Generation zero, zero motivation, zero accountability, zero manners, and for which he had zero tolerance. And now, here he was, unable to get out a single understandable symbol. Syllable. And strangely, as he had never been known to be athletic, he could easily reach his head to his stomach where, close by, for all the world to see, was a small set of testicles. Truman was appalled. He was a reserved man. He undressed only if the lights were out, much to the amusement of his wife, who, when the children weren't home, walked around the house in all manner of undress, sometimes completely naked. The final penny dropped when he was abruptly pulled from the ground into the arms of a woman who was oddly familiar, rushed down a set of stairs, placed on the ground, at which point he urinated, not into a toilet, but on a strip of grass in the open for all to see. He was horrified, and then all his attempts at denial were quashed by two words that escaped her lips. Good puppy. Puppy, as in dog. That's my dog. That's lucky. Puppy, as in dog. Lucky, hush. That was what his patient had been talking about just before he was so unceremoniously yanked from reality. She'd also been talking about reincarnation and karma, concepts that were, in his opinion, sneer-worthy and patently ridiculous. She was wondering if perhaps her disagreeable behavior in a previous lifetime might be having a negative effect on her emotional well-being in this incarnation. He'd felt his blood pressure spike, and that's when everything went sideways. However, just because all the evidence pointed in the direction of reincarnation, Truman was not about to be influenced by anything short of a double-blind laboratory study with an adequate number of subjects. Reincarnation, like conspiracy theories, was for the addle-headed who gazed at shooting stars and were convinced they'd witnessed a UFO and then enhanced their stories with additional content related to anal probing. This attempt to rationalize his current predicament, to intellectualize it, to try to make sense of it, was only minimally keeping at bay his growing sense of alarm. The painting that came to mind that best exemplified his current state was The Scream by Edward Munch. You need to chill out. Truman looked in every direction, trying to find the originator of the statement, but all he saw was a rather large and distinctly overweight bulldog. "Seriously," said the dog. Truman knew it was the bulldog that had spoken because the voice he'd heard was masculine, and the two people, standing on two legs, holding leashes, were women, and they were discussing the pros and cons of raw food versus kibble, a conversation that would normally put him into a coma. Truman locked eyes with the dog. There was something unusual about those eyes, as though he knew things that Truman did not. "You're new, aren't you?" said the dog, letting out a sigh. "It's all very confusing and frightening at first. You just need to learn how to breathe. That makes a big difference. Holding your breath starves the brain of oxygen, which causes stress." "Who are you?" said Truman, although he didn't actually say anything. His question seemed to come from inside his head. "The lady of the house calls me Butch. Not a name I would have chosen, but there you have it. We have to accommodate the lack of imagination of our so-called owners. I prefer the name Alphonse. What's your name?"
"Truman," said Truman.
"That's a good name. Is that what she," Alphonse indicated with his head, the woman who had carried Truman down the stairs, "calls you?"
"No, she calls me Bubbles," said Truman.
"Ah, well," said Alphonse. At which point, the women moved apart, and due to the restraining collar around his neck, Truman had no choice but to go where his owner wanted. "Don't forget to breathe," said Alphonse, as he lumbered off. And that's the end of the first reading.